Welcome to You Talking with Greg. I'm here with Rich Blundell, who was on John Vervaeke's podcast, and it was one of the most intense podcasts I listened to. Super exciting. He was talking about his big history world, which, of course, I've tracked, as folks know. My own TOK, Tree of Knowledge System, is a big history view, and I've been tracking that. And then the articulation you gave, friend, in relationship to the evolution out of that or through that into your current work in terms of really bridging into the arts and really cultivating this moment that we are in culturally and seeing the need for this sort of spiritual, intelligent, ecological, holistic worldview. It was brilliant and beautiful. And it's really a pleasure to have you here on the program.
Thanks, man. And me too, man. I watch your stuff and I find it incredibly intense. And, I'm on the edge of my seat. Sometimes I'm yelling at the computer or, in agreement usually. But it's just been fascinating to watch this thing unfold so fast. I mean, this is a thing, these ideas and these subjects that, they seem to just have popped in, just blossomed. But you would probably agree with this. We've been thinking about these things my whole life and haven't really been able to find a place to converse deeply about them. And then suddenly it just happens.
That amazing? It's totally amazing. That's exactly, I mean, my journey is like, definitely. I often will say I've found my people in the sense that over the last 4 years or so, there's been this evolution into this new leading edge cultural space. And certainly hooking up with John Vervaeke, hooking up with a wide variety of different people, and then making those network connections. And I think the zeitgeist and everything else is happening. You're getting this coalescence. And all of a sudden it's like, I listened to your thing. I'm like, my God, that guy's following the exact same trail. And he's another threader who's following a particular trail. It's really fascinating.
That's true. But I also feel like there's a part of this, and you have come the closest to it, without a doubt. There's a part of this conversation that is, I won't say absent, but there seems to be like a reluctance or a hesitation or such a non-familiarity with like a natural cosmology or a natural ontology that needs to get, it's having difficulty getting reintegrated. So I also noticed that.
Well, I mean,
does that make sense?
My life. What are you talking about?
Exactly.
Does that make sense? Yeah. So, my world. So I'm stumbling across a normal empirical worldview and I then fall into psychotherapy and then fall into the problem of psychology, right? And then I find this justification dynamic, which really allows me to be like, oh, it's not language per se, it's not culture per se, it's not self-consciousness, it's the intersection and a structure function of propositional networks on a culture person plane of existence that makes us different kinds of apes, okay? And it's like, holy fuck, so I'm now pulling that out and I'm gonna be a psychologist and I'll be able to now analyze what goes from us as animals, mammals, into primates, and then what makes us persons, and that's really cool, right? And I was like, we weren't 100% clear about that.
That's been missing from the whole discipline,
It really depends on how you frame it, but I nailed it. I nailed that fucking thing, okay? Justification nails it. I mean, there's just no doubt in my mind. And if I was going to be my career, okay? I mean, in other words, people get language, they get self-consciousness, they get blurred on what they mean by culture. But no one got the idea that you get symbols and then you get propositions, okay? And then propositions have positive meaning claims. They have positive meaning claims that they can quickly address with questions, who, what, when, why, where, which are simple cognitive gadgets that open up negative space around a proposition, okay? And what that means then is that now you get this dynamic iterative question answer process. To live in the world, it's not building propositions per se, it's building justifications. The issue is propositions that have served legitimizing functions, okay? And then what that then shows you is that actually social knowledge, the social construction of person knowledge, person culture knowledge, is networks of justification systems. John Vervaeke's propositional knowing, but then network together into legitimizing systems of justification. when you see that, you see the sociology and cultural anthropology view of the social construction of knowledge as the construction of systems of justification, okay? And what you see psychologically is you see what's called the personal social problem of justification, which is, fuck, now through propositional language, you have a direct highway into a portion of my knowing system, the propositional knowing directly, okay? And that goes right through the skin in a way that my perspectival novel can't. So now you have direct access. Greg, why do you think what you do? Why did you do what you do? Okay, that's the problem of personal justification. And how I explain to you why I'm doing what I'm doing is a very, very complicated question. Okay. And then what that does is it re-engineers the ego as the self-conscious justifier, the interpretive system that now has to solve the problem of justification regarding what it feels in the animal self that doesn't have access, what I would call mind two, into the social intersubjective world of mind three, shared mind three of propositions. Oh, and then, so how do I explain accidents versus what I do on purpose? How do I explain outcomes? How do I tell you what I feel inside in a way that affords me or manages social influence and how you then will respond? And that's an unbelievably important question. And what it turns out is Freud, Sigmund Freud's fundamental insight, okay, is the idea that we have an animal self called an id, okay, that we live in a social environment of acceptance and not, and you have an ego that has to rationalize your existence relative to repressing the unacceptable portion of the id. And the ego then sits in this. So Freud observes this, okay, but he doesn't know how evolutionary theory and how to explain it at all.
Right.
So
right.
You talk, the first insight of you talk is this. It's like, oh my God, Freud's fundamental insight is now placed in a reverse engineering evolutionary context that specifies right. The emergence of propositional language as the problem of adaptation that gives rise to the cultural evolution, capital C culture belief value evolution, not technological, that's a separate line, but they're interfacing. And It specifies the ego, human ego, as a mental organ of justification on top of your primate experiencing system. And when you fucking do that, you're like, oh, okay, that is fundamentally new, because you basically now can take Freud's fundamental insight and actually anchor it to the cosmic evolutionary view with a hell of a lot of fun.
Well, that's what you just did was, that was a big step you took to go from primate to, you know, cosmos.
Yeah.
And so what, the way I see it is that what you've helped do is to bridge, or at least open up a new sort of portal to understanding all these cognitive dynamics that, you know, for the past couple hundred years, we've been trying to figure out, sort out, understand. But what you did was you brought it back to the primate level, okay, and saw cognition as a function of a primate. But then where do you ground that primate? Like, what are the preconditions for the primate cognitive apparatus?
Totally.
You know, and so keep going. Like, well,
right.
Well,
so then, what happened?
Yeah, animal to
right.
Yeah.
Right. So then, what happened on 1997? Okay, the people that know the podcast know this. I'm stoned one day at 1997, mm-hmm. and I pulled out the complexified structure of the human person out of the primate, and that's where I'm looking. I'm stoned one day, and basically the cosmic evolution emerges as four steps, four phases. I go, boom, out of Big Bang came matter, then came life, then came, this was a crucial step, mind, defined as animal mental behavior, okay, which is that's another huge new angle on this, that actually we want to think about the dimension of animal as the mental dimension of third dimension of complexity, mindedness that we see. Mm-hmm. Not mindedness that's perspectively behind our eyes, but it's the behavior that we see as mental.
Enacted mindedness.
And this forecognition. It's what the behaviors, what Skinner was trying to do, okay, but then had an epistemology that was limited and couldn't then connect to certain aspects of the whole structure. Forecognition is in many ways reinventing, I call John Verbeke the inner Skinner, okay, because what he's seen with recursive relevance realization is the agent operating on the world, Skinner seeing the operants from a behavioral selection perspective. Skinner's behavioral selection is John's recursive relevance realization from a forecognitive perspective. Okay. That's why John's like, well, there's variation, selection, retention. Yeah, inner Skinner. Okay. And you're creating my system of passive behavioral investment is a transjective, iterative, interactive energy expenditure system that's kind of that's tracking the evolution of your path investment, which is a recursive relevance realization process. Okay. So that's what, and that's what animals and the nervous system itself, the animal cognitive nervous system, is a bioenergetic system nested in the living that yokes it together based on negentropic energy expenditure and information processing structures, you know? And now you have a behavioral investment system at the animal level, moving the animal as a whole through behavioral selection. That's an evolutionary process that where the neurocognitive structures, predictive processing and recursive relevance realization. So that's the animal into mammal into primate structure. So now we can specify that dimension of mental behavior, the animal mental dimension, and then put it in the life context, which then is nested in the cosmic material evolutionary context. And so one day I'm stoned, I'm like matter, life, mind, culture. Okay. Which, we all got started on this is because this is so fucking weird. This is essentially great chain of being stuff. It's like stuff that Aristotle sees, right? And then we forget, we obliterate because of the modern empirical natural science epistemology and ontology is wonderful for matter in motion, but it fucking breaks in terms of its capacity for coherent big picture shit, especially when we get into mind, whatever the hell that is, it breaks that. So I then rediscover a coherent naturalistic picture, stoned one day. And in terms of my own mind fuck, when I first developed this thing, I'm so convinced that it's so obvious, I put all over, I hide the diagram. I hide it and have my early ones do not reproduce without permission. Because I have this idea that if somebody else sees this, Edward Wilson produces Consilience in 1998, the next year. And it's like, you could totally see he's sketching it, but he doesn't have the whole picture. And I was like, oh my God, if somebody sees this, because to me, when I see it, it's a map of the universe, like a car outside. It's like, if you know what you're looking at, that's like a map of the universe. It's the right one. So, and then I was like, started to show it to people. And everyone had the same kind of, oh, it's both common sense and I don't understand it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's probably how it how it shows up is sort of, there's some kind of remembrance of it, but we've been detached from it from so long that it's now we're alienated from it at the same time.
Oh, so you have this idea that it's common sense, and then you have this idea that you're sort of immune, so it's wrong at some level, and then you have to get into the weeds about how it's both right. The updated version fixes all the old stuff, so we have ideas about what viruses are and cells and evolution and places all of that great chain of being in the right natural science worldview puzzle piece system that affords great big history clarity about what the hell we're actually talking about.
Right.
And then my feeling was, oh, the Academy's gonna love this. It's like, fucking Academy. It's like, they just don't know what to do with it. They just look at it. And it's like, okay, you can publish on this, you can talk about this, but like that, we're doing research.
Well, because the whole thing is built on specialization and, you know, the reductive impulse to reduce things down, so it's really hard to put it all back together again.
Totally. So anyway, I went off there. I'm sorry about that. But
I get it. I mean, I hear what you're saying. I just think it would be really interesting and productive to plumb, you know, some of the details of that, because it actually goes deeper than matter in some sense. You know, it gets down to what are the fundamental forces and what is the currency of the fundamental forces? Things like energy and pattern and you know,
Your talk goes to energy information fielding. So the fields, there's energy information fields, that's the ground. And then out of energy information fields springs matter. Okay, which then coheres, decoheres off of the quantum field structure into space-time that then becomes classically organized into chemical, you know, atomic chemical and aggregate matter that then behaves, at least as far as we know, in a pretty, you know, Newtonian fashion at that level. Of course, with embedded in it is this energy information field shit that 20th century physics revealed.
Well, I would probably go one step further. I mean, full disclosure, I even put another sort of level below that, which is mystery. You know, there's a point where the whole thing is obscured, and then that mystery actually, it has a through line through all of it right up to here, right? To this very, so this whole thing is actually infused in mystery too. So
exactly.
I don't claim to know at all.
But, so but that, we can't, oh my God, it's amazing. So that's amazing. So I
claim to know some things.
Right. So I am religiously, okay, I am an agnostic. Okay. So that's then going to drop into, I don't claim knowledge.
I'm existentially agnostic.
Okay. All right. I don't claim foundational knowledge about the ontic structure of the universe. I have no idea. Okay. It bottoms out with,
we can see some things. It's just that, you know, if you dig deep enough, you're going to have to confront the mystery, and you either acknowledge it or you try to suppress it. I just prefer to accept it.
So for me, there's energy information, the super force, that's then going to differentiate into the four forces, and the standard theory of elementary particle physics bouncing out of somewhere to be determined in some agnostic kind of structure. And what its ultimate grounding is I'm now, my first step into the ontic ontology is the energy super force that then is going to differentiate into gravity, electromagnetics.
But whatever that thing is, it's still with us.
Totally.
It's not like, I mean, I feel like it's here. In fact, this is an expression of it.
Right. Well, that gets me into my mysticism. Okay. So I'm in relationship to, I'm an agnostic. I'm an atheist with regards to a personal God that's like us, that cares in relation. Yes. And then I'm a syntheist, which means I believe in the concept of God and its exploration. Okay, so syntheism believes in the concept of God, okay, different than a clearly specifiable ontology of God, all right? So then it orients us as human justifiers to embrace the concept of God in particular ways, and then look to the mystical traditions and many others to seek at least experiential alignment with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so now you're talking, it's interesting because now you're talking about the, like, so you started off talking about, you know, how the field of psychology, Freud, and all that stuff have, you know, been working to untangle and understand the human dimension of psyche. Mm-hmm. And then we went down into, you know, primate, animal, yep. You know, yeah. All the way
and,
down
and then
into
the
to
life
matter.
And, then
matter. And mm-hmm. down there, we found something like spirit, great spirit, divine, whatever. But now it's when we start talking about what's way down there, we're actually end up at the other end of the extreme, which is like, so what does this stuff mean? Like, which I think is relevant to the meaning crisis, by the way. Oh. But so there's that whole other domain of this sort of inquiry where we end up exploring meaning and how insufficient meanings or sort of inadequate meanings or inappropriate meanings are manifesting today to like threaten to bring the whole system to a halt, you know, or at least, you know, reset the evolutionary process temporarily. So I just think that there's this, I'm not sure if it's through line in the way you usually use it, but there is this through line of its meaning all the way down.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's kind of what I want to try and get a handle on. Not to assume that we're ever going to get a full handle on it, but the process I think has merit.
The reason I love listening to you is because your life story affords, in my estimation, that realization. I mean, it's an embodiment of that realization as I hear your story, and that's what my life is. And I came from a particular Dawkins-esque behavioral science kind of view of the world. And I then fell back into this sort of increasingly expansive and ultimately, essentially, the tree of knowledge. In 2020, I had a transcendent period in October into November of 2020, where it was my wisdom energy period. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I created a particular flow mapping of the emergence of the wave of wisdom, okay, from energy. So you had energy as sort of the ontic bottom, all right, and then wisdom is the ultimate sort of virtue and then ultimate concern. I have an iconic representation of the concept of God called the elephant sun god that sits above and then is really, it's a combination like of the sun god Ra and Ganesha from the Bronze Age Egyptians and then into the Axial Age Hindus. And then it's organized in a particular way for me as a Westerner, seeing that in relation, okay? And then the idea essentially is a God of light, wisdom, and knowledge, okay, that is then structured to orient us, which would then create a collective, whole, cooperative structure, right, that would then afford an energy information networking that's harmonious and coherent and does those kinds of structures. And then you, and then essentially, as I found that essential equation, my actual justifying mind, for very rare, my justifying mind's very fucking active. It basically went quiet, and I sat in my cells, okay, in my perspective being, and went with walks with my dog, where I was basically a beam of wisdom energy. Okay, that's a felt experience. And essentially it is this kind of as above, so below, what is this sort of framework? And I was texting John periodically, John Brinkey, he's like, well, that's chi. And he's like, actually, that's also philosophy. Oh, actually, that's the Tao. It's like, yeah. Yeah, that's what that is.
Yeah,
and it's like, what the fuck? How?
Well, it's also from my perspective, it's also the electromagnetic or the electrostatic force that acts on a particle, you know, in some nebula somewhere. You know, it's also that orienting thing manifests across time and scale to be omnipresent.
So, right. So in my mystical state of oneness, that was the wisdom and the energy, the wisdom of the elephant sun god beaming back down and pulling the electromagnetic structure in proper work effort flow toward unity. It's like, and I'm just there in that.
Right, yeah.
No,
yeah.
You're like,
this has been going on since the beginning of time, and you know, it finds us.
Yeah.
When we're not paying attention.
And it's like, that's meaning. Right. It's like, sort of like, why? I mean, and then you look back at what other people do. You're like, of course, that's what they're talking about. It's like, why don't we do that?
Okay. So there's, I can imagine someone might stumble upon this conversation and be like, what the fuck are those two talking about? Like, so I'm wondering though, if we can't, you know, bring it down to some more accessible and you know, something that, because we just went boom, you know, okay, so we've seen this thing, we've interrogated it, we've submitted to it, we've participated in it. How do we communicate it? Is because I think that's important, like something about it wants to be communicated. And so that's something that I really spend a lot of time thinking about. How we might do that?
I love that. And I'll confess, I fall down this rabbit hole and then I basically just pursue it. I'm like, all right, I got to find this thing. I got to keep building. I got to find it. People are like, you're getting weirder and weirder. It's like, I'm sorry. I'm getting weirder and weirder in some ways, but I'm like, I'm on a quest here.
But what's crazy is that the weird is grounded in, it's grounded. It is grounded in an ontology that, you know, that is the ground, you know, that is also mystical ground. It is the ground from which the mysterious has always been emerging.
The subtitle of our podcast here is In Search of a Coherent Naturalistic Ontology That Can Revitalize the Soul and Spirit, Human Soul and Spirit in the 21st Century.
For me, I come at this as a geologist first and foremost, like looking at the history of the earth, looking at the fossil record, putting myself in those environments, you know, just sort of being, just thinking, and sometimes even putting myself in the body of a trilobite as it scurries around at the bottom of the ocean, looking at the world through calcite eyes, you know, like, and you know, all of these sort of just things that you do in your free time, in your imagination, in your free time. But
if you're built a certain way,
maybe. But I mean, that's what a paleontologist does in some sense. Thinks about what the, you know, what would the world, the Earth, be like in a reducing atmosphere as opposed to an oxidizing atmosphere. Right. Things like that. I can see the world devoid of all life. You know, devoid of anything alive, a completely inhospitable environment. How does such a place come to be? You know, populated by us and by all the diversity and this, you know, this film of activity of we call life. So when you start really imagining different scenarios for how to make this a coherent thing, it becomes a practice. It becomes a way of seeing the world through all of its different forms that it is that is manifest since it was formed 4.6 billion years ago, but even before that, because what were the preconditions of that? So if the universe is 13.8 billion years, whatever a year is, if it's that long, if we have this coherent narrative that starts in the mystery before the Big Bang, but then the Big Bang happens and some order is manifest at that point, and fundamental forces start to sort themselves out, and atoms start playing in new ways to create new structures called hydrogen or helium and things, cosmic structure just sort of emerges. So like, what do we do with that? Like, how do we take something that seems so far away and removed from human concern and bring it into the world now so that we can heal, so that we can do it better? How can we, how can we participate in this story in a more just and humane and, meaningful way? That's really what I'm concerned about. So I get really excited when I hear you, having come from the world of, psychological and, is it psychiatry or psychology is your field?
Good question. Psychology. I'm a clinical psychologist, okay, but psychology, so psychiatry is a medical discipline, okay, so you get a medical degree as a psychiatrist. I get a behavioral science degree as a PhD, and then you take that a PhD, and then inside psychology, there's a huge debate about, well, what is a professional practice, but there's then, and I can tell you a lot about, in fact, that's my entire day job, is clarifying what a psychological doctor is, very different than a psychiatrist, what a psychological doctor is relative to the science of psychology, which, by the way, needs to be divided up into basic psychology, which deals with the human, animal in general, and then human psychology, which is a specific subset. And then there's application, and then there's the professional doctor of what a psychologist is.
Doesn't that all seem like a really weird mapping it just seems arbitrary where those boundaries are.
Well, the issue is that the field of psychology, okay, the history, this is what I talk. So let's situate Utah analytically for a second, okay? So Utah is situated in a particular system of justification, okay? Specifically the Enlightenment, modern European Enlightenment, okay? And the idea with the modern European Enlightenment, from Galileo to Newton in particular, at the level of science, is the emergence of a third person quantitative analysis of behavior, of matter and motion, okay? Mm. And then they pull out the ideographic subjective secondary qualities, and they build an epistemology based on objective behavioral quantities, okay? And that's super fucking successful. For 200 years, Newton dominates, and then we're getting a new kind of epistemology.
So what I want to know is, like, how does Utah and, the whole thing, how is it going to impinge, or how is it going to transform, disrupt, and redesign all of those fields that you're describing?
Well, I know how to do it analytically in my house. Like, in terms of, like, I figured that out, because there's this unbelievable lock of a puzzle lock, and you flip the puzzle lock in the right way, and all of a sudden all the pieces fall into place. Mm-hmm. That's what happened to me. So intellectually, I figured out a way to get an enormous amount of coherence in an area that we know there's no coherence. That's why I bitch all the time about the problem of psychology. It's like, psychology grew up in this epistemological context where the epistemic structure is third person behavior. Yet the primary subject of psychology is psyche, which is by definition a first person experience. And we have all these problems of psyche relative to science, okay? Mm-hmm. In fact, the science of psychology, I will argue, is grounded in behavior, okay? And grounding in behavior is then different than the grounding of the epistemic position of the psyche. And that's no one figured out. Oh, there's a lot of complex narrative that you have to sort out to get the equation right. No one did. That's why we have the problem of psychology. Okay. It never got figured out. And instead, in my field, we decided it was impossible to figure out. So they obliterated the possibility of an ontology, and they built the identity of scientific psychology is defined as the science of behavior, because that's what a scientist has access to, and mental processes, which you have to infer, you can't observe.
Okay.
In other words, the ontology of psychology is defined by the epistemology of science. I'll say that again. The ontology of psychology, meaning it says that the world is divided into behavior and mental process. Behavior is what the scientist can see. In other words, it's grounded in the epistemology of science. And then mental processes are inferred. Okay. So that's the setup of our discipline, my discipline, which sits in this unbelievably important place inside the academic knowledge structure. Okay. Like you go down into biology and physics. Okay. And you're going to get a lot of natural science agreement about the ontology of matter and life. Okay. You get into my discipline and the ontological agreement by definition stops. There's no ontological agreement on mental process.
It seems like a sort of a cart before the horse thing, but you've still got a cart and you still got a horse. Mm-hmm. So let's see if we can't salvage what,
right. Talked as this switch little thing. It's not behavior and mental processes. The ontology is the ontology of animal mental behavior at the animal level, and then human mental behavior. And it's getting correct human mental behavior and animal mental behavior in proper relationship to life and matter below and the social science structure above.
Right.
And UTOC does that, then no other system can do that.
Right. And that's all playing out in a culture that is that is equally as ungrounded in a naturalistic ontology.
Right. So you have this broken, chaotic, fragmented knowledge system that's trying to that has no ground. Mm-hmm. I call this the enlightenment gap. There's no clarity about matter versus mind, and no clarity about scientific knowledge versus subject and social knowledge. So we have this fragmented system of knowing, which basically the academy now commits to. And it generates this unbelievable chaos of structure, which then it generates, fills in with bullshit. So we're just surrounded by chaotic bullshit.
So there's no wonder why the world looks as it does today. You know, it's that we're having to do this reckoning.
Right. So you're in the midst of systems of justification, the chaotic, fragmented pluralism. Okay. We're burning the shit out of the planet. Okay. Based on the Anthropocene and we simultaneously opened up the digital. Okay, so the digital, if you use UTOC's ontology, it says be very aware when you open up a novel information processing communication network, the opportunity for complex adaptive behavior shifts dramatically. We've now laid the groundwork for yet another plane of existence potentially through the digital, as we're in the midst of burning the planet, as we're in the midst of our industrial explosion. And I mean, and we're super fucking confused. I mean, the shit is hitting the fan.
Are you confused?
I'm not.
Right. I don't feel confused either. So
I'm saying the world is confused.
I don't understand.
And my part of my structure is why I told you the story. I need help getting to understand. I mean, I'm a clinician and I'm very good at empathizing with people, but it is weird. I see this so fucking clearly that I come in and basically like, all right, I'll figure this out. And it's like, and it's like, no, actually. And it is cool because people who have figured it out are emerging and we're networking together. I can listen to you for 5 minutes, like, that guy figured it out. it's really weird.
It's what it feels like. I have to say, though, like, as I listen to a lot of the conversations that are going on, you know, in John's orbit and elsewhere, there's a lot of reference to amazing thinkers, you know, incredibly, you know, true genius thinkers that are throughout history, but even some of those thinkers didn't have this ontology. So it just seems like we depend a lot on figuring out, you know, what these men usually were trying to, like, they were trying to grapple with something, but they didn't have the ontology that you have.
No.
So I think we need to re-examine, you know, those texts, yeah. those scripts, yeah. those mythologies, those geniuses, in light of what we now know about the continuity totally. Of it all.
Right.
And I think that needs to happen in a more, in a clearer way, I think.
Yeah, I would think so. I would hope so. And, yeah, no, I totally support that. Because there were, my system had to be built on a number of key insights, one of which nobody had before, and that's the justification problem, okay?
Right.
Nobody really got super clear. Everyone's, oh, it's language, oh, it's self-consciousness, oh, it's reasoning and reason giving, okay? This is what defines, and then there's tools. I mean, these are all the things that, okay, what is it defines humans? And it's actually, yeah. no, there's a network from the problem of justification evolutionarily as a function of propositional speech that then generates the need to build justification systems writ large and creates the self-conscious on top of experiential system that we psychologists, those of us in the know how to see, Freud.
But so how can we tell this story in a way that, you know, registers with people, you know, maybe not in its full entirety.
Yeah, I don't know.
But that there is something here worth understanding, because it seems to me like it will have profound ameliorative consequences if we do it.
Totally.
And there's so much healing to be done. I mean, I don't know how much time you spend out there, you know, face to face, but I'm you know, I've just lately been feeling the despair, you know, and it shows up in all kinds of ways, as anger, as hostility, as fear, as...
As a clinician, I live in the bowels of the human psyche. So yeah, I see.
Right. Okay. So yeah. So you see it. Well, I guess then, what are some of your case studies, and have you been able to see it working? And is there anything that you can, you know, bring back to this community so that we can also, you know, work with what your insights?
Sure. Well, I mean, there's.
I mean, your clinical, you know, your sort of practical yeah, insight.
Right. Well, I mean, the tree of life. So let's just talk about the structure of UTalk. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the structure of UTalk is there are three different things that you really want to attend to. And the one of which is the garden behind me. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The first branch on the garden behind me is the tree of knowledge. And that's what we've been talking about. Okay.
Yep.
It's called the tree of knowledge system, which is an explicit reference to the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Okay. And the idea here is that you're in paradise, but you wake up to your self-conscious word. Eve asks Adam a question. Hey, can we eat off this fucking apple? Okay. And then Adam's like, maybe. And now all of a sudden, as you eat off the apple of knowledge, you become self-consciously aware. Okay. And now all of a sudden you got a serious problem of justification. You get pride and shame and awareness of death and awareness of activity in a fundamental way. And now all of a sudden you collapse into the world with self-conscious referential capacity. That's the metaphor of Genesis. Okay. In this,
I never really engaged with any of that. So that all sounds tentative to me.
It's just an interpretation of the story. So it's a metaphorical projection onto the story that, I mean, if you listen to Jordan Peterson, that's essentially what he tells it. So,
well, I guess I just don't understand why shame and, you know, all of those things are, why are those the necessary responses to?
They're
to
not. They're not. This is the story of, And then the Christian story obviously is trying to get back to, or the Judeo story then, or whatever, we'll just call it the Abrahamic tradition, okay? Especially I'm pulling off the Judeo-Christian Abrahamic mythos, all right? Mm-hmm. And then I'm basically saying, hey, we can eat off the tree of knowledge. It doesn't have to yield us this problem, okay? And it's not that we should then look explicitly to the ontology of God for redemption in a dual world view. No, it is actually, we need to find the way of God here in the world. And if we do that, we can build, return to the tree of life. This is the tree of life in UTalk's garden. Okay. So that's the, and then you afford yourself redemption. So you get the tree of knowledge. Okay. And the garden, and that in the garden sits under the concept of God. Okay. So this then is a mythopoetic. And what the garden basically is it's a unified theory of psychology here. These four generate an architecture. And then these four is called the unified approach. Okay. The unified approach gives you the architecture of understanding character and well-being to understand what neurosis is. Okay. What is character neurosis? All right. Character neurosis is sort of the epicenter of what psychotherapy deals with. I'm the president of the Society for Psychotherapy Integration, Exploration of Psychotherapy Integration. And what they try to do is they go, okay, what is psychotherapy really about across the different schools? What is this psychological doctrine? Okay. Yeah. And there are a lot of different kinds of psychopathologies. For example, there's psychosis. A lot of psychoses probably are a result of neurochemical breakdowns mm-hmm. that then break mm-hmm. the system. And you need mm-hmm. a psychiatrist who understands the complex adaptive okay. systems of a medical doctor to recognize gotcha. That breakdown, because if that breaks, then we're in deep trouble. However, you often get software learning operating system problems that aren't reducible to neurochemical breakdowns, but still mm-hmm. causal in relationship to creating a hell of a lot of distress and dysfunction.
And the umbrella term for that is neurosis?
I'm going to use the term neurosis to define basically an operating character neurosis is an operating system that's functioning okay, but operating in a vicious, maladaptive way.
Yep.
Okay. Turn this off. Okay. So it's operating in a vicious, maladaptive way. I have a whole metaphor system for this. Okay. Behind the garden is the dragon's lair. All right. The dragon represents the rage and despair of human suffering. Okay. It's chained to what's called a triple negative neurotic loop.
Yep.
Okay. The triple negative neurotic loop says there's a negative situation and a negative feeling. And yep. then there's a defensive, maladaptive, negative reaction to that. And that is the chain because it's the way people
reciprocal narrowing.
Yes, exactly. People get in there and they have to avoid it. Oh, I'm not looking.
Yep.
They have to control yep. it, or they have to blame other people or themselves mm-hmm. for this mm-hmm. fucking thing mm-hmm. because they hate mm-hmm. the negative situation, negative feeling. And so they're trying to, the ego then tries to escape it. Okay. And we don't teach people that well, this at all. That, I mean, Buddhism does a good job. Buddhism says suffering is that pain times the resistance that you have of your attachments. And it tells you mindfully let it go through observing the witness function. Psychotherapy mm-hmm. should be doing the same basic thing, only to understand the psychodynamics of the self, okay, and how to understand what it needs and how to hold it in a particular healthy way. So that what I say, okay, basically is understand your adaptive systems, understand how they could grow healthily, how they could get chained into these maladaptive ones, okay? If you do that, you'll first get anxious and frustrated, and then you get depressed. In fact, the dragon lives in the cave yep. of behavioral shutdown. Okay. And on top of that is a personality disorder star that speaks to the ways in which your identity, your relationships, and your affect get coalesced together in certain types of patterns like narcissism or avoidance, dependency or antisocial. And they drive you in these reciprocal narrowing patterns that Karen Horn and I identified out of
hyperconsumption, I would add.
Yep. Totally. Well, you'll fill in an emptiness need that right. you're trying to get structured so you get some stimulation and some realization that you're alive because you feel empty right. and disconnected inside. Mm-hmm. 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 Totally. So you're in the fucking cave eating more, getting fat on empty calories because you don't understand the source of the emptiness, which is a disconnected from ground of meaning. There's no wisdom energy here. You're in a fucking cave trying to follow the instructions of a consumeristic capitalistic culture that's eating through the system on empty calories. You know, and okay. it's a fucking yeah, disaster.
Okay, so are we getting to the point where we can begin to break that cycle?
Yep.
And how does you talk, or what I would call, you know, ontological continuity, which is the story of the cosmos as science has sort of yep. revealed it? How can you talk ontological continuity become an off ramp of for one of these reciprocal sure. narrowings, and what? And then, so once you're off the ramp, what's the on ramp? Like, where does right. the reciprocal opening totally. Begin?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, okay. So you want to understand reciprocal narrowing and the chaining of the triple negative neurotic loop that yanks yep. the dragon further and further, tighter to the
yeah, which is cave. Which is perfectly consistent with a lot of like naturalistic processes that we see across totally. The animal kingdom, and even in exothermic reactions, and you know, even in purely what we think of as purely physical systems, this shows up. It's you know,
it's essentially a positive feedback loop where the consequence mm-hmm. generates more And in this case, a maladaptive feedback loop where the more results create more problems and that generates more results. This one has got the bit of intentionality in it, in the sense that you got an agent trying to do shit. But yeah, it's a same basic cycle process. Okay. So
that's
so,
the, by the way, that's the hidden, that's also the you know, the gift is that there is an agent in there. And
totally.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, and it's an agent at the level of a primate and then an agent at the level of a person if we're talking about us. And these two layers of agency are absolutely crucial to where we have to wake up so you can actually become aware. And once you become aware, then the difference of choice making shifts.
But aware to what? See, this is where it gets like, I do hear a lot of like waking up mindfulness, you know, being aware of these processes. But then, so then what? Okay, right. I'm aware of it. Now, give me a narrative that I can find, you know, something that's attractive, something that is fulfilling. Totally.
So basically, if you take a UTOP mentorship analysis on this issue, we're going to turn it into two different poles. One is we're going to put a basement on the reciprocal narrowing. Okay, we're going to elevate that basement so you don't go deeper and deeper into the fucking cave. And the other is we're going to explore opening opportunities for reciprocal opening.
Right.
Okay. So we're going to stop the reciprocal narrowing that diminishes your behavioral investment patterns for opening and drives you into the cave. We're going to block that, okay, and reverse it so you don't engage in what I often call character neurosis, like bringing water to a grease fire. Kind of makes sense to bring water to a fire, but these are ones that trying to place avoidance, sure, blame, and control on, it makes it fucking worse, okay? So what you do in UTOP, this little black dot right here, okay, is a picture, can't see it, but it's a picture of an eye looking down. It's the view from above, the mindful view from above. And it symbolizes calm MO, okay? So it then says a metacognitive observer that needs to be your new modus operandi, learn how to create a perspective of a sage, find a sage, learn how to create a perspective of a sage that you can activate, okay, and turn on your calm MO flashlight, okay? The calm MO flashlight then beams light, wisdom, down onto oneself, okay? And the first thing it says is be calm, like stop your anxious defensive digging, okay? Become aware. And then it says actually inside the calm is the acronym, as listeners of the program know, it's a be curious rather than closed, be accepting rather than rejecting, be loving, compassionate rather than hostile, and be motivated toward valued states of being in the short and long term rather than helpless and hopeless.
Hell of a lot easier said than done, but
Totally. Totally. This is not really a procedure. It's a guide to participation, to use John's term. So this is not like you just check the box, but you say these are the principles and processes that guide the participatory dynamic in the context. So you have to learn how to live it. But I can tell you that if you do calm MO on your triple negative neurotic looping, okay, you'll do a lot better than if you do critic, which is the critical, rejecting, irritable, tense, insistent, controlling way that people make sense, but it's grease firing them.
The Apollonian. I'm just learning these terms recently, so I'm starting to use them.
Yeah.
Apollonian versus the Dionysian.
Yes. Yes. Okay.
Okay. Sorry.
So,
go ahead.
So what we're trying to do here. So what calm MO says is I can take the wisdom of modern psychotherapy, okay, what modern psychotherapy finds, and I can coalesce it both in terms of how it's trying to diagnose entrenched maladaptive patterns, which are the internalizing conditions, which are like 60 to 80% of what shows up in psychotherapy: anxiety, depressed, low self-esteem, discouraged with life, problems, demoralized, etc. And you come in and you say, I'm not happy with me, I'm not happy in relationships, I feel like shit. You know, what's going on? Normally they die.
Well, I'm also coming up against a lot of trauma, just traumatized from all kinds of historical and or contemporary economic forces.
Why does the system feel so insistent that it needs to avoid blame or control these negative feelings, negative situations? Because of unprocessed trauma history. Okay. The sensitivity to the negative feeling, negative situation dynamic is driven by temperamental neurosis on the one hand. So if you're temperamentally neurotic, that's different than character neurosis, but basically what's the sensitivity of your negative affect system coupled to an insecure attachment and trauma, okay? So if you get insecure attachment, tied to trait neurosis, and then traumatized, adverse childhood events, then that system lives on sensitive edge of negative situation, negative feeling. So it's a hyper psychologically immune system reaction, ready to avoid blame and control.
But I was also thinking more than just family dynamics, but also just systemic dynamics of our society and so our history.
Totally. So the way in which, how does this work? The primate needs to be able to attend to the negative situation, negative feeling, bring it onto the stage and metabolize the gift of emotion, which is, hey, this is what it means about you. This is what it means about your world, your goals, your needs. And this is what you should be oriented to consider doing. Okay. Now in the primate world, emotions are basically ready to get you to move quickly because the animal world moves a lot faster generally than the human world, meaning the time scales upon which animals are operating relative to humans generally are a time horizon smaller. Like, okay, I'm going to mate here. I'm going to manage this cooperative dynamic here. They're not, I'm going to get a doctorate 5 years later. Okay. Well, this is really important because the ways in which human persons have to manage emotion because of the time scale is more complicated, meaning that you'll get energized by your primate to punch somebody in the fucking face.
Gotcha.
Okay. Yeah. But if you do that when they just got in line, if you do that in the troop world, eh, maybe you'll be a tough baboon. Maybe you'll be irritable. You'll certainly have to deal with some shit. In the person where you have to go fucking jail for, you know, seriously. Okay. So you have to integrate this over a course of time, which is a complicated learning issue. Okay. So this is what the primates got to do. How do you integrate it over time? You integrate it through a coherent wisdom narrative of yourself and society. That's how you want to be able to do it.
Well, and also the natural world, I would say that we need to find this deeper.
It's got
to
be that. Then all societies are embedded in bioecological systems that they need to be harmonized with if we're going to think long term, and especially now if we're going to think about we're doing all this damage. So if you're not harmonized in the system, then it's going to have the stacked vulnerabilities of collapse. Okay. So we live in a system where we don't understand at all any coherent narrative. It's fragmented all over the place. Yeah. We're in denial of where we can see, but at the same time, we're in denial. We're just part of a system that's eating everything up. We have no idea what we can do about it and no idea how to organize ourselves. We're also basically given such limited information about emotion. I tell a story. My three kids went through public school, K through 12. I don't think they got 1 hour on the concept of emotion, all of them.
Might be where that digital network thing, this digital communication network thing that you were talking about that we've triggered, in an adolescent way, but it might turn.
Totally.
I think it's like gonna have
every,
to play a part.
My feeling would be, why doesn't everybody know what a triple negative neurotic loop is? I mean, why wouldn't you just teach people that? And you teach, be careful, but don't avoid blame and control. Actually learn how to bring, negative feelings aren't bad. Okay. It's negative reactions are maladaptive. It's negative feelings are just valence telling you that your needs and goals aren't being met, which, by the way, is exactly what you should be doing in a negative situation. That's a valence match.
Okay, so but then you were going to go from there to, now what is the thing that comes in to stabilize and open into possibility, into different...
So the negative affect systems and avoidance structure, we have to create a base. And the other thing I will say is meditative mindfulness, okay, of the Eastern traditions, they don't look to hold the self and understand it. They look to hold the witness function and detach from the self. Okay. And both of those are very valuable ways to put a basement on this kind of suffering. So a meditative function recognizes that inside the experiential self, there's the perceiving experience. Before you grab a hold of it by the primate self, there's just the witness function. I open my eyes and I'm presented with the world. Okay. And then myself grabs that world. Of course, it's complicated, interrelated. But anyway, the self is then grabbing the world and trying to say, hey, this is why I care about it. So Eastern traditions isolate the witness function, separate that, and create detachment. So you could have mindful presence through the witness function that then isn't slave to the self's attachments and needs. Okay. Psychotherapy looks at the self and tries to create a maternal attachment structure for it and gain insight to its dynamics and clarify the interrelations between the self, the ego, and the persona, for example. Okay.
But to what end? Like, I mean, to a healthy end, but what
one end is to minimize the triple negative neurotic looping character gnosis. Now, then the other end is flourishing. Okay. This thing right here is the nested model of well-being. Okay. And it's a descriptive metaphysics of what well-being is. And it boils down to subjective fulfillment in a psychologically healthy, coherent system in a biologically coherent, healthy system, harmonized with a social material environment, aligned with core meta values. Okay. Kant said well-being is happiness with the worthiness to be happy. Okay. And what it basically says is, yes, this creates a basic structure for flourishing. Okay. Mm. Now we want to say, well, what does the system need to grow into these moments? Like I said, like I'm in a higher state of wisdom energy when I went through that transcendent. There's something that happened to there was a massive reciprocal opening and connection in that particular process that was deeply meaningful for me. I've talked about it, you know, probably 100 times over the course of these 2 years. I've referenced it regularly because something opened in my system in relationship to that. It was a transcendent experience and it was very meaningful. And I saw several things. To use John's terminology, my perspectival shift gripped the world differently. I had a shift in the way I gripped the world, and it opened me up to a more coherent unity of my place in the cosmos in a particular kind of way. Mm. And that's an example then of what reciprocal positive feedback, in this sense, a good sense of positive feedback, where my affect, my engagement, the way the world receives me and my response to that boost all sorts of different possibilities that both are enriching here and are enriching over the long term. I participated in a big history conference 2 years ago, which was titled Be a Good Ancestor. Okay. And I really liked that because it oriented my long-term value arc. It's like, okay, I'm going to position my energy, but information baton in the back half of the 21st century, as long as we get there. And I want to structure the seeding process to upgrade the operating system over an arc. It's not going to happen tomorrow because the deep structure that needs to be upgraded is profound. We got to figure out the paths to it and recognize that it's a substantive developmental process. In fact, I see this decade as the seers connecting. Okay. And then we have to extract clarity about what the message is that everyone can kind of then share in their own perspectival way that affords a coherent integrated pluralism of what this thing is. Then that coalesces right at the time around the singularity. And then that jumps out to the exponential populace that can then metabolize it and practically utilize it. Mm. And then the next generation can then socialize their kids. They get born into it in that way. So you basically do 20s to 30s, 30s to 40s, and 40s to 50s as a 30-year arc of seeing, integrating, teaching.
Okay, can I make a proposal?
Of course.
That in all of that, we need to reestablish the earth as a sort of fundamental thing or a fundamental entity to align to orient with, to belong to again. So I just think,
lovely.
So to kind of bookend what you're saying, because you've got a lot right, you know, in this mesoderm between where we come from and where we're going. Yep. And so the where we come from bit is basically, I prefer not to use big history. I've kind of had a bit of a falling out with big history because of some of its political.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's a little sloppy and a little bit too eager to pick up the scientific, like logical positivism as a thing. I don't think it's really done enough deep interrogation of the philosophy of science. It's just trying to use it, which is great. I say use it, but don't. It's not, you know, it isn't. It isn't the whole story.
Right. I'll say this. I think that, I mean, I'm actually connecting with big history people now, and I'm actually going to make a proposal that the tree of knowledge is a new map of big history affords us a way to upgrade that structure with the proper metaphysics, ontology, and epistemology that big history is lacking.
Yeah. But again, anyway. I have no sort of like, there's no hostility with any particular
person. We're on the same page. Yeah.
It's just that big history discipline is confused, and it's coming to the party. Some of the disciplines that are within it have come and picked up the science as a given, and it's just, you know, it has to sort that stuff out. And so there are some.
You and I are on the same page. So let's continue with your. I think you're right on the cusp of saying something that's really important. So why don't we?
Well, the idea there is that. below the mesoderm is this understanding of where we come from. Now, and you and John and other people that I've been speaking, they're perfectly willing to go cosmic, you know, to connect to the cosmic forces that have brought us into being, and, you know, perfectly happy to integrate into the cosmos. I find that, you know, it's hard, I think, for people to comprehend and to connect with gravity, nuclear forces, electromagnetism, supernovas, you know, cosmic scale things are hard to personalize. They're hard to feel as intimate. However, the Earth story, the story of this 4.6 billion of life on Earth, is one that is like present. It's, we live amongst it. It, you know, the record of it is everywhere.
Yes.
And it's gorgeous. I mean, it's this beautiful, rare,
right,
precious story of a planet that's done good, you know?
Yes.
And so it's just something that, so I think that the Earth as a story, the Earth's story is one that's perfectly sort of sized and positioned for us to participate in a way that, because once you've stopped the triple neurotic process, and once you've, you know, shown, given someone access to what's going on, then what? Then what can we all connect to? What can we all belong to that can start to heal old wounds, can start to fulfill our desire to be together, you know, to be in a shared project, in you know, in something that's like unique and rare, and something that we can live up to, you know. And I think the scale of the Earth is a pretty good ready-made vehicle. You know, I don't mean to objectify it, but it's a being to belong to.
Totally.
And it needs our attention. It needs us to undo, you know, the accumulative damage that we've been doing in our grasping and striving and groping for meaning. So I suppose I would just add that as something that's explicit in the process, to, you know, to wake up to the fact that if there's one thing we all have in common on Earth, is that we're all Earthlings, and that there's a story that we can tell that shows how we got here, all of us, all of the peoples, and all of the non-human
beings. The whole ecological biosphere.
Ecological biosphere, something to identify with.
Right.
And we got to take that seriously, because, you know, we get that one wrong and the project might end before we get a chance to colonize some other rock, which is just, you know, absurd. It's just such a, it's just an absurd idea to think that we're going to go colonize a rock when we've got a living one right here.
Totally.
So I guess all I would say is that, you know, as we go forward here, maybe that could be more of a common thing to live into, you know.
Totally.
Because all of what you're saying makes perfect sense on both ends, you know, on the deep analytical part that you went down into the atomic structures and the process, and also like, well, where do we go from here now that we have the tree of knowledge and the garden and the elephant sun god, and, you know, to what end? And I think it's to stabilize our home so that we can return to participating in its creative unfolding, whatever form that takes.
But 100%.
And it's not going to be perfect. There's no utopianist vision here, you know, but it's worth saying that.
Totally.
But I guess I just wonder how that, you know, how you see that dovetailing or lining up with where you're at.
100%.
Especially before we go, you know, flying off into, you know, the sun god, you know. Because we have I think we have a tendency to bypass things.
I mean, so from a UTOC vantage point, you live in the garden, try to, or the cave, or somewhere in between.
Nice.
Okay.
Nice.
And so,
and the garden. This is the garden. Right.
The garden.
Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And so then now generate a local to global fractal garden pattern. if they say yeah. that becomes. So now create a local garden and then spread the garden and then create, hopefully we'll sync up our local gardens to create a garden across yeah. the structure, and which is a biosphere. I mean, notice in the garden, you're grounded on a rock, the stepping stone for Stanford Standard Theory of Elementary Particle Physics, okay? Out of which bio life emerges, the tree mm-hmm. and the seed, okay? And the flowers, all right? Mm-hmm. And then there are animal bees, which stand for the bee of Sophia and the bee of Phronesis, which is bee with knowledge towards wisdom. And then cultivate that, okay? So that's, and then, so it's, and the message of the garden is that part of when we ate off the tree of knowledge, when we both fell into pride, we also tried to elevate ourselves with narcissism. So we'd be above, you know, nature and try to control nature. And certainly the Judeo-Christian and technological science world pulled us out and justified our human exceptionalism far greater.
Well, not all of us. It didn't pull all of us.
Yeah, right. If I'm just looking at, you know, Tarnas's Western mind, there are particular branches of justification that clearly
the dominant one at the moment has ridden that propensity.
So, yeah. So if we see that swinging justification and all of the potential implications, what are the kinds of things we need to do to correct the error? It's like get that fucking thing, you know, downgraded and regulated and get it reintegrated with a particular kind of narrative that embeds us back into the nested layers of existence that we're inevitably a part of. And the earth is the perfect, I totally agree. I love the idea of the earth.
And that thing is that runaway train it's downgrading itself one way or another. We're either going to, but it's either going to do it catastrophically or we're going to sort of, you know, deconstruct it and disarticulate the train as we're rolling kind of thing.
Right. What I think the logic of the tree of knowledge says is that we are in a flux point, and just not the logic of the tree of knowledge, just look around, but the tree of knowledge will say that we're in a particular kind of flux point as a function of the digital and the emergence of technologies and the way we're relating to the earth in all of its problematic and potential ways. And it's just sort of like, holy fuck. And getting that, if we're going to fly through the fifth joint point, open up a digital and create a harmonized structure, we better be fucking grounded in the what I would call the wisdom stack, starting with energy into matter, into life, into mind, into culture. Okay. Yeah. So where the wisdom stack is, and the, many of our autistic, brilliant people out there who know artificial intelligence think that you can, you know, bypass the structure and build an artificial intelligence domain that is not anchored to the wisdom stack. That's a fucking disaster. That is a nightmare.
I know. I was listening to your last talk and it makes me nauseous to feel, to when you say that, I feel a nausea.
Yeah, because you should, because the idea that we're going to, that this system is going to spin off into a train, it's going to create a train wreck, it's going to blow up. I argue the earth shines like a quasar of complexification in the night sky. I mean, brother, it's a quasar of complexification. So if we have a map of the universe around complexification, there's no other star that burns at all, essentially, relative to the way in which this star burns. And we're going to burn it out.
Yeah.
And we're going to burn it out.
What that's going to take, though, is something. It's a wisdom that is coupled to a skill at communicating. You know, like it's no good to just have the wisdom and the knowledge, because if you can't package it and communicate it in a way that the organism needs it in a nutritious way that also tastes good.
I say is, listen, speaking myself, I'm a theorist. I want to talk to people who can help metabolize and get the message myself. I built a particular angle on this that's pretty rich, deep, and complicated. I need to connect with people, and we all need to bring our insights together and to create a tapestry weave that can then be metabolized in the current structure in the zone of proximal development where people are, that affords them capacity to grow in that direction. That's the engineering challenge.
Yeah, and this is the most hopeful shit out there right now. Like this, I think what we're talking about, in whatever form it ultimately finds expression, I don't see any other way to get through this. I mean, we cannot just, you know, technologize our way by time, you know, by time with technology much longer, but.
No, because we're, John will talk about this artificial rationality or whatever, his concerns about pure artificial intelligence. Yeah. It will spin itself in very dangerous ways if it's not grounded to what I would call the wisdom stack. So this is a very dangerous time. And we're not grounded because the enlightenment gap breaks our knowledge structures and we are not flying with a coherent picture. So we'll grab a hold of certain kinds of things and accelerate them and create massive imbalances that because it's not taking consideration of the structure of his whole, and you create all these systemic iterations. We're seeing that happen.
I know.
The fucking scary, it's a scary thing. I mean, it's scary, but exciting. It's super exciting. I mean, my life is unbelievable. I love my life. It's structured right in this epicenter, this cosmic chirotic epicenter of it's like, holy fuck, and here we are. And are we going to be, sometimes when pessimistic, you'll hear me saying we're fucking fleas on a Titanic running around, things going to hit the iceberg. And then there are other times like we're getting together. There's a thread. There's a perspective. We're going to weave our way through and find our way to the garden. All of us is going to be glorious. So both of those live in me very readily.
I like to entertain myself to think that that's the way it's always happened. So that's the way it's always felt. But so I'm just excited to keep participating. And I think, we've cracked the nut open here. I really want to, just keep.
So let's talk a little bit about let's definitely do that. Well, you and I, tell us a little bit about what I've been rambling a lot. I'm sorry, but tell us a little bit about what you see. I mean, tell me, Rich, answer this question about how the hell we're going to do this.
Well, the way that it has sort of impinged on me, this, my engagement with the natural world, really, this is the thing, I got my PhD, but I am not a good scholar. I did the absolute, if there's anything that's like, brilliant about my academic work, it's how I managed to convince everybody that it was good enough. That's like the one skill I have. And so when I listen to when I listen to the received wisdom, the philosophical tradition that's behind all that's that I can hear churning, this engine of philosophy and science behind all this, I that's not really where I feel like the source of, if I have any wisdom, that's not where it's come from. It's actually come from first person direct experience with the natural world. I see what you and John and so many other people talk about in the way that animals move, in the way that light reflects off of them, in the way that rivers carve through a landscape, the way that a shoreline erodes. I see it in the natural world. And that's like my go-to is that there's something, there's some intelligence, I call it ecological intelligence or oika, operating that lo and behold is continuous with mine, that I and it are of the same story. That I cannot extricate myself from that. And so, my response to that question of yours would be to look to place, look to whatever natural phenomena are occurring around you. And I know that gets harder and harder to find, in some places are just devoid of healthy natural systems that have been like replaced by just rubbish, And so I know it's hard, and I don't mean to I want to do everything I can to include and to make that experience available, But anyway, that would be it. It would be to just stop and contemplate and put, but here's the thing. And this is one of the complaints I have. I work with a lot of artists and I teach them what I know about ecological systems, about nature, the science of the universe and how the ecological systems and geology, biology, all that stuff. And, they're eager to learn and know. Mm-hmm. But there's this part that's essential that is missing, which is the whole story. If you don't have the whole story, you just have little isolated bodies of, collections of knowledge, then you don't have that part, that thing that weaves you into it, because it's the story that when you trace it from its origins in the Big Bang through the formation of stars, through and the way this planet has emerged and how life has come into being and how consciousness has, and by the way, this hard problem of consciousness that never made sense to me. It's utterly like, what's so hard about it? You can see it, you know, when, especially when you understand an activism and how, you know, consciousness is this conspiracy of a body and a neurological network in relationship to a world is where consciousness comes sure. from. It doesn't emanate from a singular point. It's mm-hmm. it's about a mm-hmm. relational dynamic between a complex organism and a world. So where's the, I don't see the gap. There's no discontinuity between my consciousness and the way that granite forms, you know, things, you know, you don't see, oh, that's great. What was that?
Well, there's two, yeah, because there's a way in which I can totally follow that. There is something to be specified about the nature of the hard problem, I would say. I mean, there's something to okay. be there in relation, in the sense that we can understand digestion as a particular process, for example, yeah. a complex. Yeah. You give me a whole picture of digestion, okay? And we have and there's not a lot that's left, although this is an interesting question, but I would argue that at one level, when you tell me exactly how the neurocognitive system works, okay, there's a differentiation between our understanding of the easy neurocognitive mechanisms as information processing systems, okay? And there's a difference between that and an information processing system that has a, what I would call mind too, the subjective conscious experience being, in the sense that our causal explanatory networks are correlative, but not mechanistic clear. What do you mean by
that? Are you saying that there is a discontinuity somewhere in there?
What's that?
Are you saying that there's a discontinuity somewhere in there?
The nature of it depends what you mean by discontinuity. There's clearly complexified continuity, okay? But the question of what it is, what is the causal explanatory mechanism, okay, that can be clearly delineated to turn a non-sentient complex adaptive system with a brain, presumably that's where it starts, okay, into a sentient one.
That's where I allow a little bit more artistic or scientific license, which is to say that I don't believe it starts in the animal or the brain, or, you know, you talk about bilateral symmetry or the way that, you know, the nervous system has sort of differentiated between a sensory and a motor region, and you know, somewhere in there are the first sort of glimmers of what would later become complex consciousness. But I still don't see any ontological break. I don't see any ontological break between those two. And I see it genuinely, not just deep ontology, but a universal ontology, a universal continuity, but not just a deep ontological continuity, but a universal ontological continuity. I don't see any reason, like I may not be able to give you the specific causal micro cause, you know, that where we can pinpoint it, but I think that's the whole point, is that it's genuinely smeared out.
Well, okay, so here's another way of putting it. Presumably, if you had full knowledge, I could tell you why the neurons in my occipital lobe generate the qualia of vision. Okay. All we know is that the neurons of the occipital lobe are correlated with vision. There's no theory as to why those particular neurons give rise to that subjective experience as opposed to the reverse.
I'm just less concerned with that because because what are neurons but assemblages of certain molecules, certain proteins, which are certain, where is the neuron? You know, like where does it begin? Where does it end?
I'm simply saying that in the context of, like, if I'm a psychologist and you're asking me what's going on, okay, I can give you a pretty good neurocognitive correlative map of the various structures, like the frontal lobe. This is for planning, sorting out action and inhibition. The prefrontal cortex networks a bunch of different stuff in relation, okay? The occipital lobe does this, the hypothalamus does this, the thalamus is doing this. So I have a lot of rich mechanistic explanatory network stuff available.
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you were to ask me, well, what is this jump between this non-conscious processing, meaning, and I mean that just in a common sense way, when you go to sleep, you lose your consciousness and then your consciousness comes back online, you know, gross consciousness. We can talk about various elements, but I mean like, oh, I'm awake, I'm aware, and I have self-referential capacity, okay? There's functional awareness, which we exhibit all the time, well, to various degrees. Somebody's unconscious, you say they don't exhibit functional awareness, okay? But in addition to functional awareness, there's the felt subjective experience of being, okay? That's in addition to functional awareness. You get functional awareness first, and then you get the felt subjective experience of being, almost certainly, at least phylogenetically. And then the question is, well, what is it? We can look, and then it looks like all of this felt experience of being is in a brain, okay? Like, I don't think that my arm, I could keep my arm alive, but I don't think it would ever have any felt experience of being. If you detached it from me, all the bacteria in here will stay alive for a little while, but they won't have a felt experience of being.
But I guess my point is that all of that picks the story up from somewhere. Yeah, totally. Picks up the story.
So how
far back are you willing to pick up the story before it goes all the way back to the Big Bang?
We'll add a level of complexification and then ultimately a kind of integrated information. If you take an IIT angle on this place, you get an IIT angle all the way down. Okay.
However you want to explain it though, there's
an ontological continuity, 100%.
Continuity all the way
100%,
down.
100% all the way
and
down.
And so where and how does that, let's call it a fact for lack of a better, mm-hmm. How does that possibility that this is truly ontological circle back into the neurosis and the healing and the therapy around that neurosis? How does that? Because I think otherwise you've got a schism somewhere, that schism will show up in a schizophrenia somewhere else, and so. Until I'm not proposing this is the only way to do it. I'm just saying for me, what keeps me feeling connected and grounded and, you know, avoiding neurosis is this idea that, oh, my story is, goes all the way back.
Right.
And there's something deeply content, there's a deep contentedness that I have, that I can't really articulate, but it assuages a lot of motivations to do other things, like like acquire tons of wealth. Like, I mean, it's just like
you will have a sort of a temperamental, ideographic, deep alignment with the natural processes in the world. In other words, your particular intelligence structure, architectural structure, is enormously gifted in gripping perspectively patterns and then feeling resonance with those. So you can participate in that in a particular way that then affords real engagement. Okay.
Wow. So thank you. I mean, that's like the first time anyone's ever told me that, but that's pretty much it. I mean, not fully, but that's sounds spot on. Yeah.
And so that fills your heart with joy and meaning when you're in harmony with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, me, by the way, okay, that's actually, I'm okay with that, but that is not where my own particular gift is specifically. My actual gift is actually in empathy.
Mm.
Okay. For some reason, I can just enter anybody else's psychic field, kind of like this, and be like, oh, that's what your psyche is about in the world.
So I guess then my question would be then, given your expertise and your, you know, your profession, is there a place for this kind of temperament or this, whatever, I forget what you called it, but this kind of thing, could it serve, you know, a role in this?
Totally. 100%. Okay. So what we need is a tapestry of different lines of virtuosity and wisdom that pull together in a synergistic way. One of which is our proper relationship to the earth.
Yes. That's the one that I'm really most concerned with at this point, because this is the this is the scale at which we have an existential threat.
Exactly.
Is at the scale of the planet. So
my particular place you know, at a healing level, is to look at character neurosis, okay? And then enter into isolated souls who ground themselves into the dragon's lair through a triple negative neurotic loop and are experiencing nihilism, and they don't understand how to connect their being to the world in a real reciprocal opening recursive relevance sort of way. And I enter into that and I feel that, and I'm a psychological doctor that then wants to afford the capacity to undo those kinds of ways of being in the world.
What would a hypothetical prescription look like if you were to write one, you know?
Well, what I've extracted out of all of, I mean, at first it was like, it really boils down to, like I said, I'm going to be tracking your triple negative neurotic looping, okay? And understand the way your secondary system reacts to that tightens that chain into the cave, okay? I'm going to block that. I'm going to turn on a COM-MO loop and then find whatever the person's essence is that they have particular, think of them as an acorn. What kind of tree would they grow into given their potentialities? And then try to guide them through their own using Rogerian organismic valuing process. But I engage what's called directive empathy rather than non-directive empathy. Directive empathy affords an opportunity to serve as somewhat of a guide, an open reciprocal guide that enables the individual to find the directive path, the acorn to oak tree path that affords them to realize that potential.
And then where does the earth come into that? That's what I want to know. It's like, how do we heal the planet? With that tree you've just...
Right, because, well, what all I'm saying is that there's a multiplicity of different layers, scales, and networking, some of which are relational between people. Our relationals to ourselves, the person-to-primate and person-to-person relational dynamic is fucked, okay? So I'll give you an example. So this one right here is the influence matrix, okay? And it says our primate relational system, at its core, is tracking two related but very different things. The black line. In the center of the influence matrix, it says we're tracking our level of social influence, which is our instrumental capacity to move other people around in accordance with our interests, which at a pragmatic level is crucial for status and reproductive success and survival. And it's also tracking our felt sense of relational value, which is being seen, known, and valued by others. Okay, so it's the RVSI line, which is a barometer that we're tracking in our relational world. And it's crucial that we have both of those facets tied. Okay, so this is, hey, can I move you instrumentally? And do you know, see, know, and value me? And vice versa, okay, individual.
Do you think that the natural side effect of that then will be to, you know, to heal the planet? Because that's something that you think that's sort of a natural byproduct of that.
I think that there are a lot of areas of sickness, okay? So I think we're sick in relationship to our planet. I think we're sick in relationship to each other. Yeah. I think we're sick, like we have an enormous amount of technological potential, but it's also sick in the sense of how is it interfacing. So there's an enormous number of sicknesses. I think we need wise people like Tristan Harris looking at algorithms, telling us, be fucking careful about these fucking social algorithms we're building. We need people like that. We need people like me that get in there and say, okay, in families, why are we having a suicidal crisis, a mental health crisis, and all this other shit? How do you person talk to yourself and then other people in a family system? Okay. Yeah. We need people like you that are like embedded all in the earth at a biosphere level and fall back in love with nature, however you would frame it. And to the extent that we pull that tapestry together, you're now harmonizing across potential virtues, which is wisdom, the capacity to harmonize across, to maximize a network of virtues together. So that's what I'm
suggesting. Hallelujah, brah. I think you're right. And I think by doing it that way, you will by default activate those earthling instincts, those humane instincts that the earth has endowed us with, you know, throughout our history with it. We will reactivate those, you know, in a modern context.
It's this reciprocal opening. So I'm falling in love with how to love people in a particular kind of way. It's a clinical doctor. Like, okay, there's a way to do this, seeing all the suffering in the relational world. There's a way to have it be different. Okay. Then but as I reciprocally open and see that potential, look at how naturally I got pulled into a garden. And then I listen to your love of nature. I'm like, that guy's got a love of nature I don't have, but I can see through him the way I see the world through this lens. If I can learn from him, I will grow in a virtuous way. And it's like, yes, and if we can pull together the wisdom structures around the whole tapestry, that's a reciprocal opening, coherent, integrated pluralism.
I love it. I'm sure it's more than the, you know, us three, or at least those three architects, those three.
Yeah, no, it's a multiple. It's more than that. You know, Howard Gardner got famous for, you know, multiple intelligences. Okay, it's a intelligence is a complicated word, but they're definitely multiple abilities, multiple intuitive talent capacities. Okay, and natural intelligence is one of them. So you have a natural intelligence line that we all need to attend to, because your embodiment of being with the earth and your engagement in recursive relativization and the beauty that that affords your soul is something we all should look to learn from.
Well, I think, but like I said, I think there is this bypass thing where we're like, well, fuck the planet. We've already screwed this one up. Let's shoot for the stars.
Totally.
But I think that there's this ironic thing that you're not going to get to the stars unless you come into right relationship with this star and this planet, because I got, you know, because the universe, if there's intelligence out there, ain't going to be all that, you know, welcoming to just some upstart parasitic species from, you know, from a far flung corner of a mundane galaxy. So
the curvature of destruction, in my estimation, is not that we get to another planet. The curvature of destruction is we're going to blow this one up. Okay, if we don't change our wisdom sensibility in relationship to relating to it. So for me, the issue is, yeah, that's twisted anyway, and you're not going to get there anyway. We better fucking start wisely relating to the planet and look at people who have that natural love and intelligence for it, aka you, and then learn from that and basically learn how to see that. And if we can all see our intuitive structures and see how we engage virtuously with them and then combine that into a holistic structure.
Yeah.
Then actually, that's what this elephant sun god is an iconic representation of.
Interesting.
It's an integrated pluralistic.
I'd love to further flesh that out with you, like, because, you know, I think using the elephant sun god as a sort of metaphor for what it is, but I don't necessarily think it is going to be some currently existing metaphor for what the elephant sun god is. You know, it's whatever it is. We don't know it yet. Totally. We don't know what it is yet.
Right. And right. No, I mean, my journey is to, okay, well, in my energy baton context of this time between worlds, here's what I'm saying. Okay. And then the question will be, okay, here's what this guy saw. And then here's what you saw. And here's what John sees. And then there's a metabolizing of that for the culture.
I think the whole religious impulse, you know, we've got to figure out ways of finding each other in a synergistic way. These old paradigms of interaction are just played. They're just obsolete. So that's another.
Totally. I was just at a metamodern spirituality conference, as you know, and I gave you talk the religion that's not a religion, and it essentially is like, okay, how do we revive a sense of religio community? How do we upgrade our naturalistic notions so that we appreciate the sacred? Okay, and cultivate value with the earth, with each other, with awareness of what technology is doing, and ground us in a way that's, you know, toward dignity and well-being with integrity, which are big three values that I
would love to have gone that, but I tried and it was a full. So what's your, you know, do you have any other takeaways from that? Like,
well, I mean, part of the takeaway is exactly what we're talking about here. There are people that have particular intuitions. Some, I talked to a dancer, for instance. So, you know, it's like kind of like, hey, where's the artistic angle on all of this, right?
Nice.
You know,
and
the body, get into the body and the movement of the body and feel it in the context of the body. Okay. So I think that there are all these different kinds of potential expressive threads, and they are all going to weave together if we know how to look at them in the right way.
I was
just going to say the old modernist paradigms, which were obviously inadequate as to why we got the postmodern critique. But both of them are inadequate as a generating anything that's, you know, they generate a chaotic, fragmented pluralism. We need a coherent, integrated pluralism, which was then we listen to each of us as we, you know, the elephant in the sun god is both Ganesha for the god of intellect, wisdom in Hindu, and it's the blind man in the elephant representation. So the picture is of the old story where somebody grabs a hold of the trunk and somebody grabs a hold and says it's like a snake and it's a rope and it's a wall. And it's like, it's kind of all those things and not those things. And each of us.
And the elephant, the big terrestrial, you know, mammal,
the yes, thing which that, then of course then affords us a grounding. Again, the sun, the garden, you know, the tree. I mean, all of that is an embedded grounding in our naturalistic way of being in the world and creating a holistic naturalism. So anyway, we should probably begin to wrap up. I really, you know, all of a sudden it's like, hey, it's you talking with Greg, but I appreciate all the questions.
Well, you did open the art Pandora box, but that's a big box. I've been working with a lot of artists and learning a lot. So let's
single time. Back end to that. The main thing I didn't get a chance to totally say is as soon as I did say this sort of, I just want to come back to it. As I heard your narrative on John, it's like, yes. Okay. Like, yes. Meaning, immediately in the meta crises that we face, all right, there are particular ways of being in the world that we need to both remember and cultivate anew, and that's what I heard. Okay, you had found a line first through big history, and then you saw some of its alienation, and then you embedded it in the experience of being. You know, I do need to send you an iQuad coin. All right? Yes. Okay, and that's
what I said that, but I just have to correct you because I didn't find it through big history. Big history was just the best academic discipline that popped up in order to pursue the thing that I had. I learned it from a bluefin tuna and an oak tree. That's where it came from.
Right.
And big history is just the, you know, they were just in the way. They were inconvenient.
Well, what I am arguing through you talk, and I see this more clearly than ever, is the proper alignment between the inside out psyche epistemic experience of qualitative being in the world. And our outside in behavioral view and getting proper alignment, which we do not have.
And get them confused, actually.
We're all literally fucked up. Confused. We're completely screwed up in relation. If you place our inside out, outside in epistemic vectors properly, we can achieve, we can do this.
That's the challenge. That is the job is to do. That's called healing in my book.
Totally. Yeah. And by the way, one of the things I emphasize that psyche is a very complicated construct, but it is what we treat in the concept of psychotherapy. And it is something we need to revitalize psyche because the modern empirical natural science fucked it up completely. It basically taught it an error variable rather than the essence of the inner perspective on the world.
Yeah. And I think that the inactivist idea, this inactivist approach is going to be key to reunifying those two dimensions.
Well, Utalk does that through essentially, so inactivism comes into Utalk through what's called mental behaviorism and the appreciation of psychology and psyche in their proper relation. So but that's just, we're all
I do want to blur that a little bit more in terms of like, blur that inactivist process even further down the physics and materialist
Utalk says that we follow the tree of knowledge, grounded into an energy information field system.
And also just the way that energy, and I guess that's what the information part is, the structuring of that energy. Is that right?
Okay. So there's actually, I like to say energy equals information squared, could play off equals MC squared. And so what it says is energy then gets differentiated. So you get energy singularity and then you get a differentiation. Differentiation inside the energy creates relational patterning. Okay.
Yeah, these are essentially. There you go. Now we're talking. Now you're talking ecological intelligence.
Yeah.
That's an ecological dynamic.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And then eventually this thing is differentiating itself. And then on planet Earth, we get recursive epistemic structures, recursive knowing structures that are pulling off the forms and then building schematics to utilize the forms to make predictions so they can pull in workable energy. Right. Yeah. And then belittle workable energy, complex adaptive systems that are making predictions about where the energy will be. So they survive and reproduce. And then they become these packets of epistemic structure, which is basically what life is on top of matter. It's an epistemic, which the Enlightenment folks didn't understand that there's an epistemic causal structure. Okay. Right. And then,
but that was their project. They didn't,
the cognitive revolution, Claude Shannon's information predictive structure and information theory hadn't happened. We hadn't built. You know, Babbage has some weird shit, but he hasn't really built a computer. We don't have cybernetics. We don't have the knowledge of the brain that we have in relation. We didn't have all
the perspectives. But we also don't have the Big Bang.
We didn't, we didn't have all this. Darwin, we barely have Darwin. If you go back far enough, we don't fucking Darwin. So anyway, of course, you have all this knowledge now. It's like, we can put the puzzle pieces together and then we can watch this and the tree of knowledge comes along and say, actually there are three big epistemic processes, right? There's life, mind, and culture that have mediated through genes and cells, brains in animals, language in persons and culture, right? And then you're like, oh, okay, yeah, what the fuck? So you now have these epistemic structures on top of this ontic process. And now we want to put our epistemic information back into energy and back again, so we're properly aligned. The information squared is the epistemic knower on the information patterns in the energy. And then ultimately we do that and align that with the best possible, you get wisdom energy. So you get the epistemic structure, which is the iconic Skun God, infinitely wisdom, coming off on information epistemic back into the ontic. And then what I was doing with wisdom energy is I was toggling between the energy and the wisdom. And then all my cells were like, yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
I got it. That's it.
You know, that's the epiphany right there, man.
That's the epiphany. Great. And when I'm listening to you, I'm like, right, I'm more in this relational world. I'm now in the earth. I'm in cells. I'm not in souls. I'm back down to cells. So anyway, there it is.
Yeah. Very good, man. I'm excited. I want to do this again. And
let's do it again. And let's
continue to kind of to refine.
This is the conversation, 100%.
And also to try it out. You know, think you've taught me a lot here today, and I'm going to carry it. I'm going to process it, and I'll bring it into my conversations, and it'll shape and reform. And, you know, I just, this is the work. I think there's no better or no more important thing to be doing right now. So thank you.
Wow. Well, on that note, man, thank you. And thanks for all that you're doing. Really appreciate it.
All right, thanks, Greg. Bye-bye.
Bye.